Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 15th, 2018, and welcome to episode 170 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and, as it turns out, vintage computer festivals. I'm Earl Evans, your host. I'm sitting here comfortably in rainy Portland, Oregon, where it actually is raining. We often talk about the weather, so I just want to let you know things are operating according to normal parameters here in the Pacific Northwest. So I'm going to go around the table. We have a reasonably full table today, including a special guest, who I'll come to in the last but not least category. But I'm going to start out with Paul and ask you, how in the world are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing just fine. Everything is good. Spring was here. Tonight it will snow. So haven't even thought of an idea for a retro challenge. You know, all the sort of normal mid-April things. Taxes are due soon.
That's
taxes,
true.
I thought you Americans just would rise up and throw things in bays and stuff. And isn't that what you do with taxes?
It's a long time ago, Carrington.
History lied to me. No, I have it on good authority that some major figures in your government don't pay taxes.
Right. Anyway, but
that makes him smart.
That's true.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, before we go off the rails, I'm going to move on. To a place where I understand they also pay taxes. Jack Nutting in Stockholm, Sweden. How are you doing there, Jack?
Hello, Earl. I'm doing pretty well. I have to say that when it comes to paying taxes in Sweden, yeah, we pay a lot of taxes, but it's incredibly easy to do your tax return. Mm. Most people can just send an SMS. Done.
Are you serious?
Yeah, because they know all the data anyway. They know your income from all your jobs. Like if you have a company of your own that earns money, or if you've sold a house or sold stocks or something, then maybe you have to do something different. But otherwise, if you're just a normal working stiff with a job and your car loan, your house loan and whatever you have, they just figure it out. You don't have to do anything.
Oh my gosh.
Or you have to confirm it. Say, yes, that's correct.
That is way cool. That's way cool. My my kids, you know, they became adults fairly recently, last couple of years, and they've had to start jumping into this annual fight against the paperwork, and they're not liking it, I'll be honest with you. So if they could just send a text message and be done, wow, they might actually move to Sweden. You might see them there next week. Another place where they pay taxes is Canada. Isn't that true, Carrington?
Mm-hmm. But you Americans keep wanting to say you're moving to Sweden and here. So, no, you're not. Stay down there and fix your problems. It is terrible weather-wise. We're supposed to talk about weather on this podcast, so I will open by saying nobody should move here. It is freezing cold. There is got to be 3 centimeters of snow on the ground. It has been raining ice for the last 40 hours.
So,
we have upset some deity or something. I don't know what's happening. It's
I've
April.
Only been to Toronto once in my life, and when I was there, it was just like that. That's exactly as you're describing it.
Yep.
So I stayed underground with all the other moles on the path and just, you know, stayed out of the weather because you'd freeze to death if you'd go above ground.
Yep. It is unpleasant, so I'm going to stay inside with computers because of the weather. That's why. Right.
If
it was sunny, of course,
it.
I'd be outside in it.
You'd be mountain climbing.
Whatever.
I know. Just, like you do. So we've got one other member on the roundtable here for today, Evan Koblenz. And Evan is a high-up muckety-muck with the Vintage Computer Federation. It's an official term. Chief cook and bottle washer, and also is here to talk to us about some stuff that's going on with the Vintage Computer Festivals. But first, let me just ask you, how you doing, Evan?
I am physically exhausted, but I'm doing great emotionally and mentally.
Did you have a workout or something, or you just...
I did. I ran a half marathon this morning, my first one in 2 years.
Wow. That's pretty awesome. I don't think I could do that. I mean, I think if I did that, then the next call would be to 911. But
you know what?
I
started about 6 years ago. I can't catch a ball. I can't hit a ball. I have no athletic ability whatsoever. The first day, I went about a half mile and nearly collapsed. And now it's two marathons later. So if I can do it, anyone can.
I'm really impressed by that. And you're alluding that training and discipline and that sort of thing are a part of this.
Yes. Right.
And so, in 6 years, I don't think I've run a marathon cumulatively in the last 6 years.
This morning was only a half marathon, but it was my first one in 2 years, so it was pretty hard.
But I think, like, life total, maybe I'm approaching a marathon. But certainly not all at once.
The key to my training is have a lot of enemies and get chased all the time.
Then I should be good at this.
Yeah, I was going to say I could do that. Very nice. Well, awesome. Evan, well, I'm
yawning and exhausted, but I'm doing okay. Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you're with us. And I wanted to ask you what's coming up on the VCF front that we should be talking about. What can you tell us?
So much stuff. Let's see. On April 21st and 22nd, i.e. next weekend, is VCF Southeast, which we do not own, but our good buddies in Atlanta Historical Computing Society are running it. We support them wholeheartedly. On April 28th and 29th is the first VCF Italia in Rome, run by a group out there. And then May 18, 19, and 20, the only three-day show, is VCF East 13 here at our museum in Jersey. And August 4th and 5th is VCF West 13 at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. And a couple of months ago in February, we had the first VCF Pacific Northwest at the Living Computer Museum in Seattle.
So a lot of things that have either just happened or are coming up. The Italia show, did you say that's the first one that's happening there?
You know, I thought it was the first one, but I got an email from Salam Ismail, who formerly ran the VCF. He's no longer involved, but he's a good friend of ours, certainly. And he said to me that apparently way back in 2004, there was one Italia event, a one-time shot, which I didn't even know about until just the other day. So anyway, this is the first of the, under the new formation, you could say.
Wow. So after 14 years getting rebooted, how did that come about?
There's an organization, there's a vintage retro computing group in Italy, and they contacted us saying, we'd like to do a VCF event. Is that okay with you? And we asked them some questions and, you know, reached an agreement, and they decided to go forward with it.
That's awesome. That sounds great.
Thanks. I wish I could be there.
Yeah, me too. I'd love to be able to go to that.
That seems like it would be a kind of a good condition, like a rider or something, that you say, if you can use the name, but you have to fly Evan out.
Right, right. Well, but it's a week or two before VCF. It's like just a few weeks before VCF East. I couldn't possibly take the time. Yeah. But I'd love to go one day.
So I've been seeing a lot on Twitter and in other places about the VCF Southeast coming up. So could you give us a couple more details about that one? That's the one that's closest up on the horizon here.
Right, right, right. And again, I just want to say I don't officially speak for them because it's not our event.
Sure.
I can read what's on my website.
Mm-hmm. I might also add David Grealish was just on the previous episode talking a little bit about that. So there's some information has already come through this channel on that.
Right.
Now we can fact check him.
Yeah.
Well, I'm reading the website he made. So they got two awesome speakers. They've got one of the Vic people who work, you know, the head of marketing on the Vic 20. And then they've got Scott Adams, the famous text adventure games. That's always a great speaker. They've got, I guess, about a couple dozen exhibits. and everything from Tandy to calculators to laptops to Atari to Geos to Japanese computers, you know, modern hacks as horse as always, a little bit of everything. And so I went last year to that show for my first time, and it was pretty entertaining show. I enjoyed it. I would definitely, you know, would go back again. And anyone who lives within a couple hundred miles of Atlanta should certainly consider going.
Well, so Evan threw out quite a few shows and information for us. So now we get to show him what we do on the RCR. We're going to grill him like a fish. So the rest of you all, toss some questions his way. It's not every day we get to have Evan with us.
Lucky for your readers. listeners, I'm sorry.
Yes, we're sorry, listeners.
Well, we just apologize to our listeners every episode. So.
It's okay. I have a face made for radio, so it's okay.
Perhaps that can be something like, you know, change the sign off. We're sorry, Retro Compute. So are the actual exhibits, what's the state of the exhibits at VCF East? Are those set? Or are they still coming in?
Exhibit registration is still open. We are quickly getting to the closing time. It's a time of planning stage when I start personally picking up the phone and nagging people. You know, I know all the usual procrastinators, and because we have to order a lot of tables to rent and stuff and do a lot of planning. And so we discourage procrastinators as much as possible. I think we have 25 or 26 exhibits so far, and we expect another 10 or 15, you know, some at the last minute. But it's the only 3-day show there is. So the first day is a Friday. And the first day is a formal schedule of technical classes, how to fix and work on all this stuff. And then Friday, we have an official lunchtime keynote speaker. The Friday keynote is always more technical in nature. This year's Friday keynote is a guy named Bill Dromgoole, who's one of our members up here. And he was one of the two people who led a restoration team on our UNIVAC mainframe, which is now running. And then Saturday and Sunday morning, we have keynotes, followed by the exhibit hall and the consignment and workshops. The Saturday morning keynote is Don Eilis. Don is the man who hacked the Apollo guidance computer on Apollo 14 to save the mission. The abort switch was stuck in the on position when they were trying to land the moon. And of course, everyone knows about Apollo 13, which was nearly a tragedy, right? This wouldn't have been a tragedy. This wouldn't have been able to land the moon. But anyway, they went to land and the abort switch is stuck in the on position. And when you have a rocket ship and the abort is stuck in the on position, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. It's abort. There's no undoing that. And he had an hour and a half or so to undo it, to hack the computer. And he did it and saved the mission. And he has his book coming out, I believe, last month or this month. So he's going to be talking about that. And then the Sunday morning speaker is Dave Walden, who I've been trying to land for years. Dave was the guy who wrote the software for the IMPS for BBN for the ARPANET, the first routers.
IMPS, he said.
Internet message processors.
Okay.
And everyone else at BBN was a hardware guy. Dave was a software guy. He was one of the co-authors of the main, you know, definitive paper about packet networking and routing, what became of the ARPANET.
Man, those are some exciting speakers. I never even knew that story about Apollo 14. That's like something you'd see on TV. That's just amazing. And that must have been absolutely gut-wrenching when he was attempting to do that hack under time pressure with, you know, the whole world watching. Wow.
Yeah, and I don't want to get it wrong, but if I remember correctly what I read, he had an hour and 50 minutes. They were on the dark side of the moon. So he had an hour and 50 minutes, wrote his code, uploaded it, and it worked. I take it back. I don't think he uploaded it. I think he, you know, radioed in, you know, what commands for them to type in. But either way, he did his job. And the story, you know, the story ends. You know the end of the story. They landed on the moon, all is well. But he's going to tell us the tale of how he did it. So it should be pretty exciting to a room full of programmers.
Was he the – so sometime somewhat recently, there was a big like folder full of source code. There was like a sort of a quick video overview of it, and somebody was going through, kind of talking through the parts of the code that's in there. Was he the guy who did that? I sort of vaguely thought he might be.
I don't know, but I do know there's been a lot of interest lately in the AGC, the Apollo guidance computer. There's one person, I think, I think who's going to be at the Southeast show, by the way, who made an interesting replica system recently. And then one of the other exhibits at the Info Age Science Center, where VCF Museum is based, one of the other exhibits on campus is like a spaceflight museum, and they have an Apollo guidance computer. So that's pretty cool too. So we'll probably bring that up as a prop when the guy's giving his talk.
Nice. I was right about the thing that I was remembering, at least, so I've pasted a show link in the show notes. That was sort of an interesting thing as well. So if you want a kind of preview of what it's like to hear him talk, you can hear him talk there.
And it's exciting to me because the vast majority of collectors are doing 8-bit microcomputers. You have some people doing PDPs and whatnot. But we always try to get speakers who are a little bit more on the true history of computing side, not just history of microcomputing side. So it's interesting to get perspectives of, again, you know, people restoring a UNIVAC and working on the ARPANET and these things, because that's something a little bit outside of the scope of most, a lot outside the scope of most regular collectors like you and me. Mm-hmm. Expand our horizons, right?
Absolutely.
Yes. Lunar module is a great way to do it.
Yep. And then the UNIVAC we acquired about 10 years ago in the predecessor group. And then never in my wildest dreams did I ever imagine it would run. And now it's running. It's absolutely incredible. It's we're displaying about 11 linear feet of it. There's a lot more to it. We're displaying about 5 tons of our UNIVAC. The one we have is a model 1219B. It's a commercial version of a UNIVAC 418-2. And this model, there were a couple hundred made of this model. It's from the mid to late 60s, so it's a Sperry Rand transistorized UNIVAC, not one of the earlier vacuum tube ones. And this one we have was designed to go on Navy destroyers and cruisers. Each ship had two, one fore, one aft. It's a general purpose computer, but the input was radar and the output was shoot something. So you don't want to be anywhere near the output. And UNIVAC provided an assembler called Trim, and we found an unlabeled tape. So we loaded the tape, figuring it was just data or something diagnostic. And we found the guys on the ship in their spare time made Hunt the Wumpus for it.
Amazing.
Tax dollars of work defending their country, they wrote a version of Wumpus. So,
yeah, and hopefully kept it completely disconnected.
Yeah, it was pretty special.
And BPN and the IMPS, that's going to be some exciting stuff to hear about also. You know, there's an e-book out there. I can't remember where I ran across it, but I'll try and dig it up for the show notes, that had a lot of the history of Bolt, Beranek, and Newman. And it was a fascinating book that gave a little glimpse into why there was so much creativity and ingenuity there within that company.
The majority of their engineers came out of the MIT ecosystem. Going way back to one of the earliest VCFEs that we did in New Jersey, I think it was VCFE 3 or 4 or something, one of our speakers was Steve Lukasik, who worked on the ARPANET from the, you know, military perspective down in D.C. So it'll be interesting to hear, you know, these guys doing the commercial perspective.
And BBN.com, as I recall, I quickly looked it up because I remember it being – well, I thought I remembered it being like the first registered domain name, but it's actually the second, and I forget what the first is. It might actually be DEC.
Probably the first was DEC or CERN or something, you know, something like that. But I'm sure they were definitely one of the earliest, yes. Maybe the first commercial, perhaps.
Well, yeah, Wikipedia says the second oldest currently registered domain name. So.
Okay.
So you probably don't want to do spoilers here for the show, but when you guys were doing the renovation on the UNIVAC, do you have any interesting anecdotes from that? Because that must have been a challenging project in so many ways.
Well, certainly finding Hunt the Wumpus on a tape was an interesting anecdote. Okay, so I mean, I wasn't personally involved, you know, in the actual technical restoration. I can barely fix my Apple II. But, you know, there were tons of anecdotes just behind the scenes things, everything from the forklift pallets it's on to the, you know, the tape I mentioned. So I'm going to leave it to Bill Drongel. And the other person who worked on it was a man named Dwayne. I don't know if he's going to be able to attend in person, but they'll talk for an hour all about it. I don't really have that inside information myself because I wasn't really part of the actual team that worked on it. Most of the stories I know were just funny things that happened, not really the restoration of things. For example, we custom built new pallets because one of the power supply drawers on the bottom of the CPU was stuck and wouldn't open because the old pallet was warped. You know, weird things like that happened. There were interesting stories about one of the paper tape consoles. We'll be able to read, write and load a tape about 95%. They haven't quite got to 100% yet. It worked with Mylar tape and not paper tape, and they're not quite sure if the issue was the tape itself or some sort of weird stiction or something. A lot of stories along those lines, but the actual technical restoration of the bits and bytes, I'm going to leave to Dwayne and Bill because I don't want to get it wrong.
And then when you see it running, it's got to be high fives all around, right? I mean,
the first time I saw it power up and lights flash, and the first time we successfully loaded a core memory diagnostics test and everything, we even had to get we spent about $1,000 in special power to get it run. We had to have three phase install, which we wanted anyway for other big iron, and then this thing runs off a 400 hertz motor generator. So a motor generator isn't a generator. There's no electricity. There's no fuel. It's just one voltage in and one voltage out. So it's three phase in and then 400 hertz out, which is what they use on Navy ships. So we had a lot of time and money just to get the right power to even turn the thing on. There's a CPU cabinet. There's the dual tape drive cabinet. And by the way, each of the tape drives is about 600 or 700 pounds per tape drive and 7 megabytes or 7 meg, 7-track tapes. So that's about 100 pounds per meg. And then there's a rack called the system, the signal data converter, which takes analog data from the radar, converts it to digital, does the computing, converts it back to analog for the whatever gun you're going to fire. And then there's the paper tape I/O console. There's a teletype. There's a fourth rack, which basically is the world's biggest A/B switch. If you have multiple tape drives and multiple CPUs, it's about 6 feet tall. But we put that back in our warehouse because we was taking up space and we really need that function. And then we have one full system, which is the fore computer and the aft computer. So one's on display and one's in a warehouse for parts. And we have a pretty good run of manuals and documentation for it, some of which we acquire with the computer, others of which magically disappeared from certain government places and magically appeared at our place. I can't really elaborate on that without including it.
I wonder if I should be editing that out.
And I'm only joking about in Kimberly, but you know, some things they're probably not supposed to share, but things magically showed up at our place, some documentation.
Awesome.
Even if it's not actually true, I like the idea that the reason that in the Navy they had to have two, one in the front and the one in the back, is just to balance it so it doesn't, like, you know, tip the ship up.
Well, you know, I don't think that's true, but what is an interesting story is that these were designed to be bolted down on the ship, so when the ship, you know, tilts in the waves, the darn things didn't fall over. You know, I mean, we built custom new forklift pallets for ours, and we had to build an extensive lip in the front and then bolt them down so that when you open a top drawer of the CPU rack, which weighs almost a ton, you don't get killed or, more important, damage your computer.
Indeed.
So I was curious about the upcoming Bay Area show that's going to happen this summer. Did you have anything to mention about that one?
Sure. So this is going to be VCF West 13 because East and West are on the same version number now. After nine, we switched to Roman numerals to make it easier. It's going to be, you know, at our favorite place, the Computer History Museum out there, or our favorite place in California, I should say. And we already have, I think, 7 or 8 exhibitors already signed up pretty early. We have several awesome speakers, but we're not ready to announce those just yet. I'm looking at the exhibitor list. Somebody's doing an exhibit of electronic patterning, like knitting, on a 1985 computerized knitting machine, but made by Brother, apparently. So Brother in the 70s and 80s made these computerized knitting machines, and someone's bringing that and is going to knit things for us. That's different. Someone's doing a Neubauer computer, a Neubauer 6800. That's pretty unique. I've never seen one of those. Let's see here. Acorn exhibit. That'll be nice. Someone's doing an exhibit of CompuServe PDP-10 clones. I don't even know what that is exactly. Vintage Computer Replicas is open source hardware. Our good friend Oscar Vermeulen in Switzerland. And I'd like to mention some of the East exhibits. I think we skipped over that question. Here's my favorite thing. Have any of you heard of a computer called Moby Dick, like the whale?
You wrote about it, did you not?
I did write in my book, Abacus, the Smartphone. I wrote about that. Moby Dick. Thank you for the little opportunity to hit a plug there. Moby Dick was a computer designed by the Army Signal Corps at the facility that's now, by coincidence, our museum today. And it was designed by them in 1956, manufactured by Sylvania in Massachusetts. They only made six of them ever. It was mobile digital computer. Mobile meant it was two 30-foot tractor trailers. Laugh if you want, but you know, pretty much for the first time, they could bring a computer where the problem was instead of bringing the problem to where the computer was. And if the computers had a data center in California and the problems at a battlefield in Europe, that made it, you know, that was a big, big advancement. Anyway, one of our members, a guy named Jeff Salzman, who you probably know, he's on another podcast, and he made a Moby Dick emulator, which is just absolutely incredible. So he's going to be demonstrating that and then also giving a talk about the Friday sessions. The usual exhibits, Apple, Commodore, Tandy, of course, there's always plenty of those. There's an exhibit of Atari desktop publishing, which will be neat. Pete Fletcher is doing an exhibit called the Atari ST Being Other Things. He's going to bring several STs, all emulating other computers. Okay, right? Brian Stewart, who also goes to the Southeast Shore every year, is doing his ENIAC simulator. So I think it's incredible. We're going to have an ENIAC simulator and a Moby Dick simulator to this show, because talk about outside the norm of, you know, collectible microcomputers. Someone's doing an exhibit of mechanical computing, European computers, Krumemko's Cyclops, a demo scene exhibit. Someone's doing an exhibit called Microcomputers with an Identity Crisis, where they're going to have a selection of micros that all have multiple processors that could be different things. So like a DEC Rainbow and things like that. See Commodore Amiga Genlox, Atari Program Exchange. That's pretty cool. SGI exhibit. Someone's doing an RB5X robot. Oh, we're doing an OS2 exhibit. Bill Degnan's doing an exhibit called the Altair Jukebox. Apparently, in the February 76 issue of Dr. Dobbs Journal, there was an article about, you know, how to do the famous demo where you get radio interference from an FM radio through Altair. So Bill Degnan is a musician, so he made lots of songs based on that programming method, and he's going to do an Altair jukebox exhibit. So that's going to be amazing. I can't wait to see that. So those are some of the coolest ones that have signed up so far. And then on Friday, we have technical classes. We need about four or five more, but the classes so far, I'll just quickly run through those. A class about vintage computing with FPGAs. Someone's doing a session about collection disbursement, about what happens when you die, you know, how to make sure a collection is handled correctly. Someone's doing a talk about computing and transistor logic, class about microprocessor design, fundamentals of logic circuits, Apple Lisa repair. And I'm going to give a class about my favorite subject, which is Lego robotics for 8-bit computers. So I'm going to give the latest, greatest version of that talk just because I want to.
And having you go through that makes me immediately wonder, what are the plans, if any, for capturing it on video and like some of the, either the workshops or the talks or any of that stuff?
We have an AV committee, and they're working on that as we speak.
Cool.
Pretty good at recording. We're really, really bad at processing and uploading.
Yeah, that's the way of things.
Yeah, Kevin Savitz is our hero. That man can upload, we think he has a time machine or something. Kevin uploaded a massive, massive stash of 5 or 10 years worth of old VCF video archives. And he did it in like a month. It was blown away.
Huh.
And they're on a website. If you go to our website and mouse over where it says events and scroll down to VCF archives, all those videos are there. Thanks to Kevin.
Excellent.
Very cool. Yeah, that is. And I have that same question, Paul, because that particularly the Friday session on vintage computing and FPGAs, that's been a topic I've been interested in of late, and I'm actually trying to scrape together enough information to make a podcast episode on that. So
our loose plan, if you can call it a plan, is to record these and little by little upload them one at a time, spaced out, you know, maybe a few weeks or a few months. We decline to stream. We like to have some exclusivity to being there in person.
Oh, sure.
In due time.
Yeah, that's always kind of a question with Kansas Fest, it's such a long event that there's a lot of people who can't commit to going to it. And, you know, there's everybody who's not there often wants to see some kind of stream of it. But there's always this question of like, well, is that going to make it less likely for somebody to go if they could just, you know, point their web browser to it? And I think it is.
I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Mm-hmm. You go.
No, that's fine.
Okay, I was just going to say, I mean, everyone tells me that long-term streaming works to your advantage as an event manager because it entices more people to say, well, that's cool, I got to go next year. But there's also the other side of the story, which is a little bit of possessiveness about, hey, you know, you didn't buy a ticket. Oh, well. But, you know, our compromise is, you know, we record and we do post in time. At K-Fest, you've got two silver bullets. You've got Kevin and Jason Scott there. So that's if anywhere could get it done, it's certainly that crew.
Yeah, although, I mean, and now just diving into the like deep technicalness of KFest, neither of those two people are on the committee. And like in general, the official Kansas Fest organization does not itself stream. It sort of encourages people to do what they want to do, but they're not going to get involved in trying to make it work.
It is a lot of work. And, you know, just like our event, there's a small number of people who do the majority of the work, and there's a whole list of all points you want to get done in a finite amount of hours in a day, and we do as much as we can do.
Right, right.
I mean, it's a lower priority. So.
Yeah.
And with something like K-Fest, something that will come into the equation, I think, is the fact that last year it essentially sold out. So it's an event that keeps getting bigger and bigger. They have a capacity of 100 people. If it hits that capacity and stays at that capacity, they literally lose nothing if they stream it because they've sold all the tickets they can. Like, so once you're at the point where you're right. selling That's out every year, you may as well stream just because, you know, it's not that if people stay home. But if you're at the point where rooms are going empty, then I think it's a different equation.
Right.
Good point. Very insightful.
Well, also with something like K-Fest or the VCF for that matter, if I'm watching a stream of, let's say that nobody showed up to one of those events, except for the presenters. And now they're just streaming. It would be kind of like that old, and I don't know if it's an urban legend, but the tale of the university professor who got tired of all the students just coming in and putting their recording devices at their desk. And so he just came in and put a playback device at his desk.
Real genius.
Yeah, I was going to say. Everybody was jumping in with that.
And so when I think about, you know, what would I really be streaming? What would I be watching if I'm just watching a presenter and I'm not watching an actual event with people interacting? It'd be no different than watching a pre-recorded YouTube
video. I see we all go to Kansas Fest as telepresence robots.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And joust.
Well, naturally. And no one's there to pick us up, so there's some real stakes.
Yeah. Right, so the pickup and drop-off gets real easy. It's just ones and zeros at that point.
Now, if we're telepresence robots, do we still have to pay for the rooms, the dorm rooms? Because they don't
need
sleep.
But you need the power plug.
You do. Yeah, you need 110. So.
But you can probably have, you know, like 12 roommates.
Yeah.
You know Jason Scott's robot is going to just kick open the front doors and be like 8'5" and 700 pounds. It's like, I'm here to record.
Be a total mech.
And it's going to have a top hat. It's going to have a top hat and a Pac-Man
Absolutely.
Suit.
I think...
Well, Jason.
Yeah, and Quinn's is going to have a flamethrower.
I think you're striking the right balance, though, I think, Evan, by recording them and then playing them back later. Because, you know, that you get the best of both worlds at that point. So, well, let me see. We've kind of danced around the various shows. Anything else you wanted to let us know about?
On the VCF front, let's see. So,
yeah.
The Vintage Computer Forum is, you know, firing away, doing the Vintage Computer Forum thing. And the museum, every year we go on a spring spruce up for the museum, make it nicer and prettier to look at. Oh, here's something very important I almost forgot to mention. So every couple years, you know, our museum is what, you know, is maybe about, shows about a fifth of what of our entire collection in the museum. The rest is in our super secret storage warehouse where the public can't go. And collections come in throughout the year, and sometimes we have to take some things we don't really want to get the good stuff. And sometimes we take things maybe we shouldn't have taken, and it's, you know, things just kind of arrive. And we're much more selective than we used to be, but things tend to accumulate. So every year or 2 years, we like to have a surplus sale. Not really a sale, but we have the consignment room. Of course, there's no flea or swap at the show, but there's a massive consignment area and there's a vendors area. And we made a lot more physical space for those this year than in past years because some new rooms on our campus became available and the sellers were upset with the lack of space before. Anyway, when we have too much of our own stuff, we write down some numbers and in exchange for modest donation to our organization because it's a nonprofit, you get to have something. So this year we started putting aside the things that were surplus, and we have tons of dot matrix printers. We have dozens of Commodore disk drives, 1541s, 1571s, 1581s. We have a case of Commodore 128s. We have a case of, I think it's Atari or Commodore, but tape drives and all sorts of miscellaneous stuff. So we have about 6 or 7 forklift pallets full of surplus things that we no longer need or we have too many of that will be available Saturday and Sunday at VCF East, all in exchange for small donations to the organization.
Very cool. I imagine that's going to be a popular stop for people while we're there.
Oh, yeah. And it's great because for us, it's, you know, a small amount of fundraising. It creates space in our storage facility, which is always very important. And it gets really good stuff into the hands of members cheap. None of it's tested. It's all as is, you know, no warranty is expressed or implied. But, you know, people may be buying 2 or 3 of things to get one, you know, to have parts to make a working one. Or you may get lucky and all three might work. You know, it's sort of a pull the slot machine and seeing what happens. So we're looking forward to helping the hobby like that and helping ourselves by making some space in our warehouse and doing a little bit of fundraising too while we're at it.
You didn't mention the pallets of the Altairs. Are you going to have that this year?
We definitely know pallets of Altairs. We own 2 Altairs and they're not going away.
Gotcha.
We have our daily driver out there, which is the one in the museum. It's, you know, a little bit banged up, but it's the one we use on a regular basis. And then we have our other out there is a really special one with really cool provenance. Well, actually, the daily driver one also has some provenance. It was used by a local college professor. But our other one, so everyone knows about the Homebrew Computer Club, of course. And people talk about it as if it were the only one. MakerBot, you know, founded a few years ago out of NYC Resistor Hackerspace in Brooklyn. And I think that in 20 years now, people may look back and talk about NYC Resistor as if it were the only hackerspace. And you guys know there's hackerspaces everywhere. It's a global phenomenon, right?
Mm.
Well, mm-hmm. The same thing were with computer clubs in 1975. Homebrew Computer Club is obviously legendary, but it wasn't first. There were clubs just like it all over. They just weren't famous. The same month as Homebrew Computer Club formed, there was a group called the Amateur Computer Group in New Jersey. And 40 years later, a few years ago, we had a 40th anniversary reunion panel. We have all their printed newsletters. And it's funny because that group has a DVD of their newsletters. We have the printed ones. So they have to come to us if they want their actual newsletters. But we looked at volume 1, issue 1, and it says, here's a list of all the people who attended meeting number 1 in May 75. So we were able to contact about a dozen of them. We had a reunion panel. It was pretty cool. And one of the people who was at that first meeting brought us not only his out there, which he used and demoed at that meeting, which means it was probably the first out there anyone in New Jersey ever saw. He also brought us his homemade TV typewriter that he used and demoed at that meeting. So we have the TV typewriter in the museum. The out there that he gave us is in storage, and it's the pristine one. The daily driver one's a little scratched and nicked here and there, but it's the one we use and work on and hack and stuff like that. So we're pretty fortunate because when we started in the predecessor organization 10, 12 years ago, we were like, ooh, you know, a different revision Commodore 64. How cool is that? And now it's like, yeah, one of our Altairs. So we got a little spoiled, but we have 2 of those that are definitely not for sale.
That was a very fortunate. That was a donation that he gave you of that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Our policy is we only accept donations. We do not purchase artifacts.
Sure. Sure. That makes sense. And the TV typewriter, that was the Don Lancaster style kind of device, or?
Yes. So we had one already that was made out of a metal box. This one was built out of a cardboard banker's box with the wood grain paper side. So it's a pretty unique looking system.
Wood grain was essential in the 70s. Your computer had to have wood grain. Or
I'm a product. I was actually born. It's funny because the Mark 8, the 8008 computer, was the July 74 issue of Radio Electronics. And, of course, the Altair was a January 75 of Pop Electronics. I was born October 74, so I'm also a product of that time. But no one collects me. No one has a collection of that.
Excellent stuff. Well, Evan's going to stick with us on the show, which is awesome. We're going to jump into the normal routine now, I think, where we cover listener feedback and then talk about some items of news and interest, and then talk about what we all want to buy on eBay. So for listener feedback, I'm going to turn it over to the King of Swing, the indisputed sovereign. And I think you were mentioning you wanted to incorporate the word fiefdom somewhere in there, right, Paul?
Right.
Regarding listener feedback. I don't know. I'm going to have to wordsmith that a bit.
Yeah,
but why don't I turn it over to you for this?
Okay. Except my computer totally froze. I'm not actually sure why I'm still able to talk to you.
Well, we're glad that you can.
Oh, my goodness. Do you want to do things a little out of order?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I didn't want to interrupt what was going on, but I may actually just need to restart the computer.
It's all good.
Hey, I just thought of a VCF thing.
Oh, go ahead, Evan.
Online ticketing will be open imminently at vcfed.org. Victor Charlie Foxtrot Echo Delta.org.
For which show?
For East.
For East.
And then immediately after East, we'll open ticketing for West.
Very nice.
Forgot to mention that. Sorry.
That's good information. You guys get your tickets now. And, well, not now, but when it opens. Yeah, soon.
It's like the scene in Spaceballs. When is now going to, you know, when is then going to be now, sir? Soon. And the VCS Southeast crew just announced a couple days ago that their show is going to be free this year.
I saw that. That was right neighborly of them.
I'm not privy to the how or why, but I'm happy about the is.
Yep. Just, getting the, lowering whatever barriers to entry, like one Twitter person had said, you've got no excuse now not to attend. Carrington, you're recording everybody, right?
I am indeed. I'm the backbone of this show.
Nobody
would have guessed that.
Carrington, he's
our
official archivist.
That is a major
archivist.
Surprise.
Well, since you're the backbone of the show, I'm going to turn it over to you so you can talk about the first item of interest and news.
Oh, which, sure. Yeah, that one's mine.
It is.
A thing has launched, and it is an interesting thing. It is, unfortunately, all caps, Irata Online. The Irata is fine. It's the all caps. So many caps.
Maybe they didn't have lowercase. Maybe they didn't have true descenders.
But I do. But I might not dig the spell or the capitalization of the name, but I dig the thing. The thing is a Plato service. Now, I had no idea what that meant. Turns out Plato stands for Programmed Logic for Automatic Teaching Operations. It was essentially a computer-assisted learning thing developed through the University of Illinois. I'm going to say the S is pronounced on that state, and but became more famous really as a big timeshare system that had chat and notes and online games and like all the fun stuff of a big timeshare BBS essentially. Well, fast forward to now, the Plato stuff has gone by the wayside, but emerging from the ashes like a all caps phoenix is this new community for retro computing enthusiasts, which is Irata Online. You can get to it by going to www.irata.online and you can sign up. Now, I have signed up, I have dove in, and I have enjoyed it very much. So if you wanted, let's say you've been feeling the urge to do one, to be like the cool kids in the retro community and like get on an old school BBS, there's some serious barriers to entry to that. I've been interested a lot, but it's like, do I have an old computer that I can telnet out of? If I'm doing it on a website, will it be the same experience or what have you? This one has a super low barrier to entry. Go to this website, you can click a little sign up button, you type in your info, and then you can download a already compiled, ready-to-go client for this system. There's ones available for Windows, for Mac, for you can just get the source code, you can get it on Linux. So really, it's just download an app, launch it, and then you type in Irata Online and your username. There were some snags in my process of getting online, which is I went to the website, filled out the info, where you choose a username, and you say go, and you're supposed to get an email back from them right away. I never got anything. And eventually I was like, yeah, I'm just going to jump in. And I was able to just log in. So it does seem to create the username. And the first time you go to log in, it just says, okay, well, you're new, make a password. So maybe you don't have to do the whole online sign-up thing, and that's just nonsense. I don't know. I did it, but I think I could have skipped it. once you get online, it's like a BBS, but there's also chat, there's games. So if you miss the old like door games, that kind of thing, there's multiplayer online games. It's got graphics. It's very, very cool. It is super retro. It's got a retro feel and a retro look. It's like using a BBS. It's very text-oriented. So it doesn't have all the modern-ish comforts of menus and stuff, like mouse-based menus anyway. But it's polished. It's neat. It looks really cool. I was super, super impressed by this. Will I keep going on there? I don't know. There's still... It's more awkward than just going into a Slack or something, but it is way more retro. It's designed for retro communities. When you sign up, you say, like, do you want to be in the Atari group or the Apple II group? Or, well, you know, there's Apple II and then there's other, and those many others. But everybody should check it out because it's free. It's available now. Super low barrier to entry to get online. And then even they're saying, like, what will come of this? We don't know. We just want to make it exist, and here's a new community where we could chat and leave notes and ask questions or... Who knows what? Who knows what might grow out of this? Maybe something really cool. Maybe nothing. I don't know. Definitely worth checking out. So go to Errata Online. That part you can do all lowercase. And then you can download the app and log in and you should check it out. Have any of the rest of you checked this out yet?
I haven't checked it out, but I've heard a lot of good things about it from other people.
Mm-hmm. I was super impressed. I gotta say, I'm kind of half joking about the all caps name, but I'm very impressed with the way this was put together. It was so much better than I thought it would be, and even that I'm describing now. Like, it's definitely something worth checking out. I was surprised at how cool this thing is.
So I've signed up based on you putting this in the show here. I mean, I love it that I'm not. How's that ad go again? I'm not just the hair club president. I'm also a client.
I'm clearly neither of those. But yes, go ahead.
So a couple things that just struck me right off the bat about this. First off, it will, I think, increase knowledge, maybe preserve some of the legacy of Plato, which is an incredibly important system historically.
Okay, so you had heard of that before? I'd never even heard of it.
The Plato system? Yeah, for sure. And the fact that you hadn't heard of it is kind of like what I'm saying here, is that it's very historically, but also not that well known. And one way possibly to cure that is to jump online and take a look at the Computer Chronicles episode where they talk about Plato and show off some of the things that it could do. Very, very fascinating. The other thing that I like about this is that they're trying to make it extensible by giving you information on the protocol and the language that it speaks, its own built-in language that you can use for developing content so that you could build something off of this. They say that they have the clients that they have, but they'd like to have more clients. They'd probably like to have a Commodore client and an Apple client and a this client and a that client that could connect up to it. And they're building in the documentation that'll let you do that. You can get access to that on their website. Mm.
Which... And I should say, like, the heavy lifting is done by the system itself. Like, this thing called CyberOne is what created PTERM, and PTERM is that software I was talking about that's just available. You can just download and go on the system. So really, like, the system itself is either a mainframe system or running mainframe emulation, I think, on some, you know, somebody else's computer, the cloud. And the PTERM stuff just seems to be a terminal emulator to get access to it. So, but the heavy lifting really is what's happening at the other end. So I think it shouldn't be massively difficult for other people to create clients for this, because you really just got to, you know, send stuff and receive stuff.
Yeah, true client server kind of approach. Yep. Very
nice.
If
anyone's interested in the history of Plato, in November last year, a new book came out called friendlyorangeglow.com is the website. And the book's called the Friendly Orange Glow. And it's a wonderful history book all about the Plato system.
That's a good name.
Very nice. Yeah.
Did you read it? Have you read the book?
It's on my queue to read.
Yeah. Mine too.
I'm wondering if the replica was inspired by the book or if it's a coincidence.
Yeah. Good question.
Don't know, but I know it's underrated historically. I think more people should know about it. I think it was one of the first places where you had this kind of interaction via computer system, you know, kind of like a collaborative sort of thing. So I definitely want to read that book too. I hadn't heard about it until just now. So hopefully we can squeeze a link to that in the show notes as well.
Yep, already there.
Being an educational system, I wonder if perhaps I hadn't heard of it because maybe it was never outside of the U.S. Like, no, it started with University of Illinois, and maybe spread across your country like a benefit or a plague. I'm not judging. And then I don't know if it maybe never came to Canada. I don't know if we had like super awesome better things. You don't know. You don't know.
I remember that when I was a kid in Minnesota, I had the Play-Doh software that I got from my Atari at some point. And I found a number that I could call to sort of log into this, but it was a long distance number for me. And so I didn't really, you know, I think I probably tried to call it sometime and connected to something and probably did not have an account. So I couldn't actually even do anything, but I remember that it worked. And I saw that, like, it was interesting because it was very different from the BBSs because it was a kind of a graphical screen in some way. And it was, I mean, it was text, but it was all sort of like, it was not just like a terminal window. There was something like the text could be positioned in things, and there were graphics. Even the login screen, you could see it was sort of different from the way a typical BBS login looked in. But that's as far as I ever got with it. So I'm very curious to see the rebirth of this and actually try it out in modern times, which I have not yet done.
I would recommend that everybody does. Like, if you're listening to this podcast, then you're keen on this kind of thing. And this is like a retro system that's been reborn, very low barrier to entry, and it's specifically designed to be like a discussion community for people that would listen to this podcast. So, like, I strongly urge people to check it out. We'll have a link in the show notes for people to go check it out, or you can just go to irata.online. And you know, maybe we'll all chat there. I don't know.
On the other extreme of that barrier to entry, you mentioned some of the online BBSs or just Telnet. I'm sure there's some out there that are dial-up, but mostly it's Telnet or people using the Wi-Fi modems now and that sort of thing, which is a wonderful thing the last couple of years, those Wi-Fi modems. In the VCF, one of our projects we're working on is an honest-to-gosh dial-up BBS. So hopefully that'll get done in sometime, you know, by the end of this calendar year.
For people who still have phones.
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, from what I understand, I don't know if it's changed at all, but any sort of phone, you know, modem communication that goes over VoIP, essentially, or you know, Skype or anything like that, might not work very well, particularly at any kind of high speed, because the audio can get scrambled a bit. I mean, like, even apart from just being compressed. So
I believe that's true. We're going to great lengths to acquire the right telco equipment from the period, so that if someone does have a line that works, we're ready to really accept the call.
I
had an acoustic coupler modem back when those were a thing that was a couple little pieces and it would strap to a phone. So it was like a portable one. They got to make one of those that straps to an iPhone.
Right.
And one thing we're going to do is we're putting a PBX, you know, a real PBX in our museum so that we could put a dial-up modem next to, you know, Atari 100 or TRS-80 or whatever, and a child can come into our museum, sit at the computer, and actually hear the handshake and actually connect through our internal PBX and find out what happens if someone, you know, how you got knocked off the internet if someone else picks up the same phone in their line, et cetera. It's something totally foreign to a kid today, that concept that you get knocked off the internet if someone picks up the phone line, right? So even if we have challenges getting outside connection, will still be people that real world experience in our facility.
That would be a neat thing for people to be able to see. And I've actually looked at on eBay and Amazon a couple places where you can find these PBX cards that go in your computer and just become a PBX and would actually allow me to have a straight modem to modem connection.
Right. Well, one way to do it is with a PBX card and an asterisk, of course. The other way to do it is to acquire an analog PBX.
Right.
We did the latter, and we're having a, you know, friendly gentleman's bet in our organization because we have one person who insists it's not going to work that way. So we'll see.
Which side are you on?
I'm the one who decided to purchase the analog PBX, right. So I've got something invested in it. We'll see what happens.
If I can give you dial tone, and if it can handle the right voltages and signaling, then I'm pretty sure it can be done. I'm on your side, Evan.
Modern Chinese analog PBX from eBay. So we'll see. $100, you know, we'll see if it actually works. There's just because something standard is compatible doesn't mean it actually works.
Fingers crossed.
Can I tell a little story about standards?
Yeah.
In the late 90s, I was working for a voiceover IP testing laboratory in Connecticut. And there was a standard back then when voiceover IP was new called H.323. And we had two gateways we were testing. And one of them kept picking up, getting a dial tone, calling the other, and immediately disconnecting. They were both H.323 compatible. We couldn't figure out why it didn't work. Why wouldn't they connect it? And we found out that one system used the pound DTMF tone to connect. And the other one used it to disconnect.
So that's like having the abort switch stuck in the on position.
Pretty much, yes.
All right, well, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite things, which is the Commodore 64. And it turns out that people just can't quit making reproductions of the Commodore 64. So there's another one now. Have you guys heard about the C64 Mini?
And on the Commodore 64 Facebook group, they seem quite upset about it.
They're waiting for the C64 Nano.
or the Pico 64. You know, I've noticed this too, that whenever there is a new product that comes out that is quote-unquote nostalgic for the Commodore community, it is often controversial among the Commodore people. You know, some love it, some hate it. It's like... I don't have one of these yet. I just want to let you know it's out there. You can take a look at it and to some of the YouTube videos that I link to and decide whether or not it's interesting for you. I'll tell you what it is. It looks like the breadbox version of the Commodore 64, and it's a 50% down scale replica of that. The keys don't actually work. It's just something that's the keyboard is just there for show, but it does have HDMI for connecting up to a modern TV or monitor. It's got a joystick that it comes with and USB ports, which you can use to connect to a real keyboard, a real thumb drive if you want, move files around, that kind of thing. It's got a bunch of the Commodore 64 games built into it, and one of the interesting things the folks were saying out on the internet, you know, this is always a thing too, is does it have the games that I remember or the games that I played on the Commodore 64 versus a bunch of games that I don't remember? And so that's a point of contention for some people, but it's got a bunch of games built in. And so there are several unboxing videos and reviews of this. And one of my favorites was the 8-bit guy. Did a thorough segment on this, and there's also a bunch of others, so I just put the search query in our show notes, and you can take a look and see what you think. But it's a reproduction of the Commodore 64, actual functional. I mean, you can program it in BASIC if you want to do that. I don't know if that were the case, what would distinguish it from just an emulator like VICE that you could run on your system. In fact, just in general, this feels to me like a lot of these things have felt like, that it's just an emulator in a really fun package.
Mm-hmm. What they're going for is they can sell them in Target. I mean, they have that Oregon Trail thing game now, a little handheld Oregon Trail you can buy at Target or Kmart. They're going for that crowd, the impulse buy of folks roughly our age who don't know that vintage computing is a hobby. They're not going for the collectors, you know, like us who are on a Commodore Facebook group. The decision not to put a keyboard in my mind is very foolish. But and the decision only to put games in there. I mean, yes, you could program it, but, you know, anything that propagates knowledge of computer history and our hobby is good. But, you know, putting it out there as a game machine only and no keyboard, and I guess it's good. People, you know, maybe people will get, maybe one out of 20 customers who buys that thing will Google for more and find the VCF or find your podcast. So that's good, right? Rising tide lifts all boats. But I can see as a collector why it's something to kind of put your nose up at a little bit.
Yeah. And I think you're right about the target audience, that, you know, this is going to be the same roughly target audience that you'd have for something like the Atari Flashback or some of these other systems that you can buy, that they've got the games that you remember playing as a kid, and it very, you know, easy setup. You just plug it in the TV and you start playing those old games.
Have you guys seen the Oregon Trail thing?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I know Ken bought a batch of them. He was saying online, but it's fun. I played it. It's fun, but that's not for us. It's for the impulse buy, the general public.
Paul's got two of them.
I do. I actually do.
So you guys have played them.
We did an unboxing.
I think it's ironic that I live in Oregon, actually at the end of the Oregon Trail, and I haven't played this.
Because of the dysentery?
Exactly.
It's a safe space, you can tell us.
Didn't want that to happen to me. So, cool. Well, anyway.
I have an Oregon Trail story I'll tell you guys when we stop recording.
You're that listener, you don't get that.
Right. Special bonus content.
I'm looking forward to this. Well, that's it for this show. Right. No, we'll wait on that story.
One thing I was noticing in this list of they have a big sort of spread of all the games. You know, it says the best C64 retro games included. Quite a large proportion of these are Epix games. I'm wondering if they do you know if they've actually arranged for rights to something, or.
Well, I'm sure they have. I don't think you'd come out with a commercial product like this without going to the rights holders, would you?
Well, I would.
You care to would, but I mean, just in general. They probably did. And, you know, those were some of the more popular games for the C64, actually, titles from Epix.
Okay.
I read a review on armchairarcade.com, my friend Bill Lodgetus. And if I recall, he was saying that the game selection was great in quantity, but quite poor in selection.
Ah. I think they did have one of the most popular games, Impossible Mission, for the Commodore 64, which is, kind of a landmark title in some ways. People just love that game. And I'm pretty sure that I saw that
it's there
on the list. So,
Column 7, Row 2.
And they do have Jumpman, and they have Paradroid. Paradroid's also great.
Yeah, Jumpman was the one that got me. Jumpman was a time sink of epic proportions. I can't imagine how many hours I spent. I just love that game. I still love to take it out and play that one. And I didn't like that game on some of the other platforms, but I loved it on the 64. So, all right. Well, Jack, making of Dark Castle, I'm not even sure I know what Dark Castle is. What is this?
Oh, you have missed out. Yeah. Really?
I don't know of it, I'm sorry.
You're about to learn something cool.
Dark Castle was a pretty amazing game for the original Mac, maybe not the 128, but like you think of the old black and white Mac, and this was a game designed for that, and so you only had two colors, right? Black and white, but it's actually beautifully done. And was kind of, I would say this is of the early, like, say, mid-80s Mac games, this is probably the pinnacle of them. Like, before there were color machines, there was very little better than this in terms of graphics, how it looked, how it played. And so, anyway, the link we're talking about here is an article on Gamma Sutra. It's entitled The Making of Dark Castle, an excerpt from the secret history of Mac gaming. It's basically a chapter from a book called Secret History of Mac Gaming, and this chapter is all about Dark Castle, and it's really interesting. It's a very good read. It's a pretty lengthy read, talking about just a variety of things about the development of this game, what they went through, the choices they made, and it is well worth your time to read. And if you haven't seen the game before, it has some screenshots, has some videos and things, gives you a hint of what it's like. But I didn't play a lot of this. I actually didn't have a Mac in those days. I remember playing it on friends' Macs in college and stuff. But it's a very good read anyway. And it seems like a game that has... There's a lot happening into it. It's a platformer, but there are a lot of different activities you do on different screens. It's not like, say, Super Mario Brothers, where you kind of have the same things you're running through, jumping through. And it's not scrolling. It's one screen at a time. This being from 85 or 6 or whatever. But...
Yeah, I played a lot.
How about you guys who played more of this? What do you? Yeah.
the sounds in particular. I mean, like it really did, actually it took pretty good advantage of the Mac. I mean, so the graphics were very fine and they worked well, but also like the controls required the mouse. Like it actually makes it a little bit hard to emulate in some ways because, like when you're aiming this rock that you throw, You actually have to do that. Like, the only way that you can do that is with the mouse simultaneously with the keyboard.
Right. You move your character with the keyboard and aim with the mouse. So it was kind of like how all first-person shooters work today. You're sort of, your left hand is movement and your right hand is aiming something.
Except this is a side-on platformer, essentially.
Side-on
with
thing,
bats and rocks and whips and a dungeon. And it's, the graphics are amazing. There's humor in it. It's one of the best early Mac games, and it's like shockingly good. It is so beautiful, and the sound is so nice, and it's just an absolute all-time classic.
So, anyway.
Is it available to use in emulators?
It must be.
I would assume so.
You know, honestly, I don't think I've played it, though, since I must have started this on an emulator. That would be crazy if I hadn't played it since I had an SE30.
That's what I'm thinking, too. Oh, you had an SE30?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, check out this guy.
I think I'd like to do that, too, play it in an emulator. I miss something by not seeing the gaming community, the Macintosh world.
Oh, you can play both of the games.
Well, when I was using Macs, it was in a corporate environment. And as you might imagine, they kind of frowned on us bringing in a pile of games and starting to use them on the work computers. So I know things like the Claris software and some of the other like database environments or whatever for the original Macs, but desktop publishing stuff, but not this. So yeah, got to take a look at that. Let's stay on a Mac-ish kind of topic, I think. Aren't we going to, Paul?
Sure. That sounds good. So the thing I wanted to talk about here is basically it's a recreation of the 1987-era HyperCard called ViperCard. It's at ViperCard.net. And this is actually relatively recently put together. There's a GitHub repository where the development is happening, and you can actually sort of try it out on ViperCard.net. So there's you can watch a demo video. There's a glider game that was, I guess, written in HyperCard and ported to ViperCard. But almost everybody who used HyperCard, maybe not almost everybody, almost everybody who used HyperCard loved it.
I loved it.
Yeah. I never quite got into it very much, but I still, I understand what people like about it. It's very sort of object-oriented. It's got a nice little programming language, and it's a pretty low, you know, this is the episode when everyone gets to say barrier for entry, right? But it's a low barrier for entry. It's doesn't take very much to make it do things. And that's relevant on the Mac because there weren't other kind of like simple programming environments on the Mac. And you know, of course, fairly famous things like Glider itself, I guess, is a pretty famous thing, but you know, Myst, lots of things.
And Myst,
were done in HyperCard. And so what's being done here is essentially a return to 1987. I think it's not entirely finished, you know, so it's not everything is implemented, but the goal is to basically make a modern sort of HyperCard that works like the old one did, you know, so it's backward compatible, you know, can actually use them. These are not the only people who have noticed that, you know, HyperCard was good and is gone. So there have been other sort of HyperCard successors. And so I didn't put this in the show notes, but someone did. But there's SuperCard, and I believe, so I'll say something about it, and then whoever put it there might know more than me. But I believe SuperCard actually is itself pretty old. Like I thought that might have been something that launched almost parallel to HyperCard but kept going. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think the SuperCard that exists now, I'm the one who stuck it in there. Uh-huh. I think there was a SuperCard concurrent with HyperCard, and its idea originally was SuperCard is like HyperCard except it had graphics. Mm-hmm. And then HyperCard kind of added graphics and QuickTime stuff sort of as an extra layer stack. It was really, really awkwardly shoehorned in, and then HyperCard just sort of stayed around for a while and then eventually just wasn't even canceled so much as forgotten. Mm-hmm. And SuperCard, I think, kind of went away, and I'm not sure if the current SuperCard is exactly the old SuperCard or if somebody like bought it. So it's the same name. Mm-hmm. It's and I'm fairly certain SuperCard is compatible with like a modern Mac. Like it still works even if you're on OS like 10.12 or whatever. I think so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I haven't used it in forever. I was a huge HyperCard fan back in the day because, like you were saying, Paul, the Macs were one of those first early computers that didn't ship with a version of BASIC. It's like, here's your computer. Why would you need to program it? And HyperCard was this really cool
thing. They didn't make AppleSoft BASIC for the Mac. As a separate product you could buy.
Yeah, but as a separate product. Yeah. It wasn't like an Apple II or something where you fire it up and here's your programming. There was a barrier to entry, which is, you know, clearly a theme. It's a theme.
Yeah. We needed an episode title.
Yeah, so HyperCard was essentially like completely compatible. It could open HyperCard stacks, but it was like the color version. And the whole idea, the neat thing about HyperCard, I mean, I haven't touched it in forever, was it was my introduction to object-oriented stuff, but it was more as my introduction to event-based programming, where like a button gets an event that says, hey, a button has been clicked, what do you do? So it was, you know, all the stuff I do now in JavaScript I did back then in HyperCard, and it was super fun and it was pretty and it was really easy for kids to program, and I really liked it. And so SuperCard still exists, and I guess the advantage of HyperCard is it's going to be a free thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas SuperCard I think is somewhere between $200 and $300 for a license for it.
I see.
Which isn't a lot when it comes to programming things nowadays, but is a thing.
Right. It is a different barrier to entry.
Yeah, I just checked. It's $279 US for the full one, and there's, I guess, an Essentials one that doesn't, I don't know what they strip out, probably database stuff or something.
Do we know who made it? Which project is it?
It's Paul's. Paul gets all the money from that.
SuperCard?
Yep. And
no, ViperCard, I mean.
Oh, ViperCard. Well, let's see. It's Ben Fisher. Ben Fisher, GitHub account, okay. Downpoured. So that's what I know about it. But it's quite new. I mean, I think it's like a couple weeks ago that it sort of first hit GitHub, I believe, and it's last updated 15 hours ago. So I mean, it's still brand new.
So this is very cool that people are doing either recreations of this or that they're taking a look at that technology that was so useful back then and thinking, what do we do with that today? Because, you know, Carrington's right. You've got the...
Carrington's right.
you've got the event-based programming where, you know, you click something and you have a handler. Something happens. It's the way everything happens these days, but it was kind of novel then if you were just jumping in and playing around with this. Also mixed types of information on a card where you've got some graphics, you got some text, did HyperCard do audio? I mean, it seems like you could have
plugins for a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. X commands.
The other thing was, I think a really big import with HyperCard was I've got this card, this page of information, I can click something on that, and contextually, I go to another card of information. What does that sound like? That sure sounds like something that happened
in the
90s. Yeah, exactly. So very important product and neat to see that they're doing this stuff. I can't wait for this thing to be done to play around with it a little bit.
And actually, maybe I should also mention this one last link, which is which again I didn't put there, livecode.com. So this looks like another sort of kind of like quick programming environment. But
yeah, I stuck the one in there, and that's kind of another way to go for people that like miss HyperCard and want a modern version for whatever reason. Like I really like those things back in the day, but nowadays it's just easier to, you know, code. But if you're missing HyperCard and you want a modern one, that can make standalone apps or whatever. Like SuperCard's one way to go, and it costs a little bit. And then there's LiveCode, which can cost anything from nothing to, oh my goodness. there's like an open source version that's really limited, and I think it can't make standalone apps. And it's free, though, so you can try it out. And then it goes anywhere. And then you pay like this annual thing. So SuperCard is something where you're going to drop somewhere between 150 and 300 bucks or whatever, and you then own it. LiveCode is more like a licensing thing. So you either get the free one, but if you want to start making your own apps, depending on whether you want to sell them or not sell them or put them on the web, or you can pay anywhere from like $80 a year to a couple of $1,000s a year for the license. It used to be way cheaper. I have a LiveCode license. I never used it, but back when they launched and ages ago, I think it's a UK company, they offered a, you know, business one, like a full develop, do anything you want, web things, anything. And it was something like $200 for a lifetime, get all the upgrades ever. And I'm like, yeah, what the heck, I'll support you. And I've never used it, but holy moly, I guess it's worth it now. Although it was $200 for something I've never used, so maybe it wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. But boy, howdy, does this company constantly send me things saying, hey, why don't I upgrade to the latest version? And I can switch over to a license where I'll spend $2,000 or $3,000 a year instead of the one I have that's forever for free. And I don't think they really understand my position.
Yeah, I see. Okay, so it says it belongs to the family of Xtalk scripting languages like HyperCards. So it is inspired by that.
Yeah, so that's the stuff where it's basically English. Like, so, and AppleScript is like that. It's these English things where you say, tell button number 7 on card number 8 to click itself. Or a click says, send this message to card 18, bring yourself forward. And then when it brings forward, like, so just message passing things where objects in there can send things to each other. And LiveCode and SuperCard and AppleTalk, and or sorry, rather, AppleScript are all that kind of thing where they're quasi-English. I would argue that makes it a little more complicated once you're used to coding. At least there's rules. And AppleScript always seemed to be like, guess the word I'm looking for. It's really more like an Infocom game that results in maybe a program. back in the day, I really liked them. And there were great ways to sort of introduce these programming concepts. So I was a big fan of HyperCard back in the day.
And I don't know. I mean, you say it's easier to code. It might be easier for people who code to code. But what if you're not a coder? But you still want
become
to produce
one.
Some. I guess that's it. But that's a thing. I mean, with something like HyperCard, you could put together content that was linked to each other and was multimedia, and you didn't have to be an expert. You didn't have to know all of the ins and outs that you have to know even to produce anything meaningful and good in today's web technology.
Which was the idea behind things like BASIC, whether or not it's true that that's actually an easier way to begin or not. Like, that's always been the promotion, that that's easier. And HyperCard was something where if you wanted to make like your own little database, you had a collection of CDs or tapes and you wanted to make a database that you could enter stuff and print it out and add things, bingo, HyperCard was just right there. You could just, off you go, just start typing it in and it'll just work. And so for that kind of programming, or to make a little point and click adventure game or anything like that, it was a really, really powerful thing to like way to go. I think the downside was, especially at the beginning, was it was stacks. So you weren't sending somebody a program, you were sending them the stack that they could run and therefore modify. And I think that hurt its commercial appeal for a while. And then there became compilers where you could compile down your stack into a standalone game that really just was bundling inside it an interpreter that was the full HyperCard thing. And it was therefore kind of easy to break back out and look at people's stacks. So I think still it had a commercial difficulties getting adopted for those sorts of things. But boy howdy, was it good for the hobbyist and for home users. And for me, I did some professional things and I really liked it.
Hmm. Well, hey, well, you've got the con. Carrington, why don't you tell us about this Antic special, because it sounds really cool.
Antic is a podcast that's almost as good as ours. Well, my first news thing was educational based. It was that IRATA Online, which is based on Plato, which I have learned is some sort of American education thing. And there was recently an episode of Antic, which I joked wasn't as good as ours, but really is a fantastic podcast. And there was a special episode on something called Bits and Bytes. Now, Bits and Bytes is, and really my news thing is to tell people to go and listen to another podcast because it is that good. It is that special an episode. There's sometimes something is done in our community that just kind of rises above the average. And this is one of those. So even if you're not like an Atari person, because Antic is an Atari podcast, but this special episode should be of interest to anybody who's interested in retro computing at all. So there was in 1983, Bits and Bytes was a musical theater production that ran for hundreds hundreds of productions. And it was designed to be supplement to classroom education about computers. I think it was aimed at a broad range of kids, like from grade 8 all the way down to kindergarten. And the goal was to show them that computers are important, but they're not scary, and though they're just machines. So while they're super useful, they're not a panacea. And so it didn't just talk about how awesome computers are. It presented ideas about human responsibility, all wrapped up in musical theater. Like, how amazing is this? So the idea is there's Morton B. Norton, this really enthusiastic computer salesperson in a store called computer rama that's designed to look like a giant computer, and that's our setting. And there's also a couple of computer kids who I think either worked at the store or maybe just hung out there. I'm not really sure what kind of child labor thing was going on. Anyway, they help Norton remember stuff about computers, and they dress up like computer characters to entertain the shoppers. And the shopper in question for our plot here is a girl named Happy. And cue the music. It's amazing. This is an incredibly well-researched episode about a really interesting subject. And there's interviews, and it dives deep. It's, again, a thing I'd never heard of. I think would have just maybe been just lost to time if you weren't in the area where this was a production. It's incredible. Like, I was blown away by this episode and just this amazing thing that I'd never heard of before. And I don't think we should... I mean, we should just link to their, because people should go off to the Antic show and listen to their episode. And in their show notes, they link to a ton of great supplementary material. There's a Bits and Bytes study guide, and that and a ton of other related material are linked in the show notes over the Antics episode. And it's amazing. So I don't know if any of you have listened to this Antic very special episode, but I would strongly recommend it. It is just terrific. Kevin Savitz, who we like to talk about on the show, has done a really amazing job with this one. I think you should be very proud. It's pretty swell.
Yeah, I've started listening to it. I haven't made it all the way through, but you know, the beginning was good. So I'm looking forward to hearing the whole thing.
I was quite impressed. It is pretty fab. So thumbs up.
Excellent. Well, now I'm looking forward to hearing it too.
Hmm.
And wondering how many more, I mean, you mentioned Carrington, something like this could get lost if somebody didn't know about it or preserve it. You just have to wonder how many of these things didn't
seven.
Get preserved. At seven? Is that
seven. Wonder no longer.
Thank you. I thought it was 42.
Answer is 42.
I said it first. Okay. Paul, I think I'm going to let you close it out here. And no spoilers, though, because I subscribe to Retro Man Cave on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
And oh my gosh, what a fun channel on YouTube. I haven't mentioned it before, but man, there's some great content on that channel. And the guy's just so awesome and so low key. Doesn't he feel like he's just your buddy? Like, you know, you feel like you're, you know, sitting right next to him. But anyway, you had a specific episode of this that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so this one is this actually only just got posted quite recently, so it's about the next station, and says When Steve Jobs Left Apple Part 1, and the hint is in the title that there's going to be a second part. So what he did basically is he has a Next Station Turbo Color, and he sets it up with a mouse and the sound box and the monitor, and kind of goes through what the computer was supposed to do, how it was marketed, and actually sets it up, shows stuff, some of the internals and the hardware and stuff like that. Talks through it basically in more kind of detail, more sort of technical detail than I've seen other places. You know, like I've seen other videos of Nexts where it's all very pretty superficial. Like I know all of those things. And this, at least, you sort of feel like you're actually getting to know this machine a little bit. So the first part is basically just sort of talking about the hardware, and has nice little, clips from Steve Jobs himself promoting it. And then part two is going to be a little bit more about the actual software ecosystem. So
I think, but I'm not sure that the Cube came out before the Next Station.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, the Cube was the first. The Next Station Turbo Color was basically the last of the Next branded hardware. But the Next even continued on beyond the making of the black hardware. So they then moved on to Intel machines. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, they started, I think they ported Intel in like 93?
Yeah.
Well, for a while, so Next had the thing where you could build one app and run it on their 68,000 machines, on Intel, on HP PA RISC, and on Sun Spark stations.
Uh-huh.
Like all running Next up, which was kind of crazy. But it worked.
I think... If I knew about the Spark stations and stuff, I had forgotten that. But
yeah, it was weird. You could either run, like, you could run Solaris, and Sun had their own sort of implementation of kind of the OpenStep APIs, like the Objective-C libraries. Or you could just run NextStep straight up. You can install NextStep straight on a Spark station. Cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so the video is pretty neat. And I'm drawn to it by the fact that I have NextStation Turbo Color that I want to set up. I mean, like it does boot, but I haven't really done the appropriate stuff with it. You know, like it basically is just using the hard drive that it came with, you know, and I would kind of like I want to put a solid state drive in there and actually probably address the capacitors, which are probably very close to done. And that's
over
sort of
in VCF land. We have a couple of original stations in decent condition, one of which we've restored and works. We badly want a cube. So if anyone knows of one available, please contact us.
Yeah, the cubes look really nice, although almost every cube that I've seen has been kind of beat up. Like the paint must be attached in a very weak way or something.
Well, the cube is not just nice looking, it's historic. The cube is, first of all, the first one, and also the cube is what Tim Berners-Lee used to make his program called World Wide Web.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's I respect the cube, but I just the cube just they always tend to look kind of used.
The ones in the wild look a little beat up, yeah. Is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, have you seen the internet lately, recently? Like, oh, my goodness.
Right.
It's looking a little beat up, too, isn't it?
See, now that's what the internet in the IT crowd should have been a next cube. That would have been that would have been better.
Mm. Oh, well. It would have been better.
Anyway, so that's basically all I wanted to say about the video. It's just that if you kind of wanted to get a relatively deep idea of kind of what the NextStation Turbo Color was and how it fit in the history that leads up to, you know, Mac OS X, but also, you know, starts with the internet and so forth, it's pretty well described here, and pretty well produced video. And it's part one of two, so there'll be, even if I've spoiled part one, there's still part two.
And did you see the one that he did on the RISC PC, on Acorn's RISC PC stuff? Because that one is awesome also, and learned me all kinds of new stuff that I didn't know about that particular model. So yeah, just his channel is fun. So take a look at the channel just in general. And I'm going to be watching this next one pretty soon. After I get done with the Atari Antic podcast episode and sign up for Viper Card and do the Play-Doh thing, I'm all out of time.
Yeah.
Because of this RCR. It's crazy. So, Paul, the next step, you've got the upcoming show roundup, and we covered the VCF upcoming shows in some detail. It also looks like there's one other here, Tandy Assembly, that, you know, that's exciting, but that's out a while, right? That's October.
Right, right. And Kansas Fest, the registration opened right around the beginning of April. There's a limit again this year, but it's a little bit higher. I think it's 120. Is that right? I think so.
I think that's right.
Yeah. They opened up more rooms on a higher floor, and there's even a little bit of a discount if you volunteer to be on a higher floor. So register if you want to go, because there's a chance that it could fill up and then you can't go.
Register early, register often.
Yep.
That's what we say.
So I'm doing all this from memory. You'd think I would look up the webpage, but yet here I am just talking. So if I say something wrong, hopefully someone will correct me. But the cost is sort of in the neighborhood of $500 for the entire time that you're there. So I think it's like a Tuesday night to Sunday day. So it's cheaper than it would be to stay in a hotel during those times. And they also have college provided food, and you can listen to probably 40% of the previous RCR episodes to hear other details about Kansas Fest, but
worth every penny. I'd go back in a heartbeat. This year I have the Hope conference that week. I can't go, but I would go back in a heartbeat if my schedule and budget allowed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that is a not uncommon conflict. Actually, I think Hope and Kansas Fest do tend to be very close together.
But Hope is every other year, so at least there's that.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, that was news and items of interest. I hope you found them interesting. But if you didn't, here's something else. Here's a word from our sponsor.
Wishing you could join in the Christmas cheer, Ebenezer?
Wishing I could get my hands on that Commodore home computer.
Well, they got theirs at Canadian Tire.
Uh-huh. This week, get the Commodore 128 personal computer, just $444.44. The 1571 disk drive, $366.66. And save on the Commodore 64, too.
But why a home computer, Ebenezer? You're just an old penny pincher.
Ah, but with a computer, I'll know precisely how many pennies I have to pinch.
So we're back, and Paul had had some technical difficulties beyond his control, and so what we're going to do, I think, we're going to move the listener feedback to next episode. Now, we love listener feedback, so we want to let you know, definitely don't be put off or off-putted or, you know, whatever iteration of off and put you might get from this, because we definitely will do it. Just not going to do it now. Right now, we're going to go on to the host retro computing gift idea, which I don't know. What do you guys think? I think this is amazing. This is something that truly has to be seen, to be appreciated, I think. So if you're listening to this where you can click a link on the show notes, you have to go click this. It is a retro floppy disk cookie cutter. So if you want your cookies in the shape of a 3.5-inch floppy disk, and let's face it, who doesn't, then you definitely want to go get one of these.
It's very cool. Yeah.
And I guess that's it. Nobody...
I like it. I'm all for it.
Say, don't leave me hanging, boys.
You have to click that you accept cookies.
Right.
Oh, that's good.
The demo, the little demo cookie looks very good, actually. I mean not tasty, but I mean, like, it looks like a very good representation of a disc.
It's just too bad that it's only the 3.5 one. I wish there was a 5.25-inch cookie cutter.
Right.
Maybe just use an actual
pretty big cookie.
Just press it into the dough.
I want an 8-inch cookie. Yeah. I think it's you could make like a pizza that size probably.
Well, that's a hard drive.
Yeah, okay.
It's a calories thing, FDA approval. So with that, now that we've paid for things, we can get on to spending our money on eBay auctions. And Carrington, you're up first. What
Trivia
you got for
fever!
Us?
That's my new theme song. So I am selecting a still sealed, rare, all caps, Irana Online, vintage 1984, as it says, Trivia Fever game from the Apple II. And the reason I selected this isn't that I think it's amazing. 4 hours left, no bids. I am sorely tempted to buy this, even me, only because how fun would this be to have at Kansas Fest? Now, do any of you have one of these, in which case I don't have to buy it and bring it to Kansas Fest? Not even Paul?
I do not.
Yes, I do.
Oh, excellent. So nobody should buy this if you're going to come to Kansas Fest, because Paul will bring it. I want to play this game. It's a computerized game of fun-filled trivia. It's like an Apple II / board game thing. I'm really keen on that kind of thing. And this seems like the perfect game to play at Kansas Fest. And this is $45, still sealed. Unless it's Paul selling his copy, then nobody needs to buy it. Just need to be friends with Paul.
At least the one I got, it came with this weird little fuzzy character that had a little ribbon that said, I think something like, I have trivia fever or something like this. It was this really weird little thing. I posted it on my Twitter stream at some point, but it's, what does it say? Something like the hottest new game in town. Yeah, there it is.
Well, the neat thing about this is there's a sticker on it. So I think this was like a game that came out early and then stuck around for a while. Mm-hmm. And there's a sticker on this box that says use with or without Apple II series, 2, 2 plus, 2E, or 2C, and it has $5 rebate. So I think that probably means it's an older game, but it's interesting that you can play it without a computer. So there you go.
Uh-huh. Yeah, inside they have a little thing that, a form you can send in. Like if you bought this but you don't have a computer, then you can send in for your rebate, you know. So the idea is it works as a traditional board game, but the computer can help, which is kind of weird.
It is weird. I'm sure this sold like hotcakes. Anyway, I want to play the Kansas Fest. So that is my choice. $50, Paul should buy another one.
Sounds good. in fact, I have somewhere, I have a couple of little like add-on packs as well with like extra questions.
Of course you do. That's amazing. You should make an add-on pack specifically for Kansas Fest, and then it could be a game.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that would be a super fun game to do as a session.
Cool.
In fact, this would be great thing just to run as a session. Bingo, you got yourself a session. Fill it out and say you want to host Trivia Fever. But you got to say this.
So everybody
Fever!
Here. Yeah, yeah, except you are the one that's going to be saying that.
I'm totally okay
Not
with
me.
That. I will just sit on stage, and every time anybody says Trivia Fever, I will add the magic to the game.
You want people to actually come to the session. Oh, very good. This is very good. And I'm not surprised at all. I don't know why, that you actually do already have a copy, Paul. So I'm going to go on to my auction here, which is a... And so I got to ask you guys, did we not cover a very similar computer to this on an RCR a
probably
while back? Because it looks similar, but I just love it. It's a Toshiba HX10D, and it's one of the MSX series of computers, which means it's one of a generation of computers designed to be compatible to a certain extent with each other. I like this particular model just because of the layout. It's got this square, rectangular actually, layout of the case, but the keyboard has the different colored keys, and I think they're very pretty. It's very nicely laid out. It's got both the Roman characters on the keyboard, and on a lot of the keys, it's got the Japanese kana characters. So it is apparently bilingual, which is awesome. It's also an auction that's actually here in the U.S., which happens from time to time with these MSX computers, but sometimes when you're buying them from overseas with all of the attendant risk and delay that goes along with that. So it's available locally. It looks cool. And I think that actually, since it's tested, the opening bid of $99 is not bad. So many computers that you see on eBay, as a pet peeve of mine that I just keep bringing up, my co-hosts tell me, shut up, but I'm not going to do it. I like to see the computers tested, because otherwise you don't know what you're getting. You're just going to buy a box of plastic and parts, and you know, it becomes a project as opposed to something that you can actually have fun with. So this one, they say it's working. They say it's clean. You look at the pictures, and it truly is pretty clean looking. I mean, you could even display this even if you weren't going to actively use it. So I don't know. I kind of like it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I definitely like it, and I do remember. I think I can kind of reconstruct, actually, the discussion that went around this, because I have one that is very similar, but it's not a D model. It's an HX10. And Carrington speculated, I think, that if it hadn't been for that difference in the model number, he had assumed that this was somebody who had taken mine and is selling it.
That sounds like something I would say. I threw a link in show notes to msx.org, which is like the big resource online for MSX things, if you're interested, which are Z80-based computers. Supposed to be like a big international standard, and it wasn't. But if you're keen on these, you want to know more or figure out what the heck we're talking about, msx.org is the place to go to. So it's a very busy site. It's not a very attractive site, but tons of info there. There's like a wiki. There's modern news. If you're looking for emulators, if you're looking to download stuff to run on your computer, figure out like what models exist of what, like, it's all on there. Like, there's one very large site that is just like the place for people that are keen on MSX, and so that is msx.org.
Cool. Yeah, I haven't really done much with the one that I have, but I do really like it. I mean, like, the reason that I have one is because it is so pretty.
They are very pretty. Love the keyboards in particular on this one too. Just absolutely gorgeous. They look like they would be very nice to type on. Like, they just look like computers that would be very pleasurable to type on.
I think I will actually counter our previous announcement of not doing feedback, because there's one bit of feedback that I might want to put in here that's related to this.
Do it. You rebel.
Fatty over Facebook, he pointed out a video that he recorded about setting up a MSX emulator, which is OpenMSX, on a Raspberry Pi. So he's sort of compiled the right operating system and everything, and shows how you can select the different ROM for the different machines and so forth. And I think actually I think the machine he has might be this one.
Oh, cool.
In fact, but
nicely done. Way to go.
So I mean, if you're interested in doing this, it's a cool thing to follow along with.
So it's probably a discussion for another day, but I wonder why, when you had this idea of this common hardware platform that would be predictable, but then companies could expand from that, you know, they could embrace and extend away from that, why it didn't go over any more than it did. because...
Question asked and answered. When you have this standard that everybody can change, so it's not a standard, why didn't it become a big standard? Well, I don't know how to have this discussion with you people. It's a standard or it's not.
Yeah.
Or the nice thing about standards is that there's so many of them. Maybe that's right. The... So, Paul, save us here. On eBay, what have you got for us? First off, it looks like something that will help us avoid paying taxes, which was a subject from earlier. So,
yeah, I thought this was kind of cool. It was the result of an actual search this time. But there's a Tax Avoiders Atari 2600 video game new inbox.
You're on a list.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. I actually did look up, you know, some gameplay video of this to try to see what it was. And I just don't know that Atari 2600 games are for me. But
they can be some of the best 5 minutes of gaming you ever have.
Yeah. So this was my childhood, man. I had nothing but good memories of playing Atari
games.
And
there's a couple that really do stand up, but there's a whole big bucket of ones that don't. Right. I like the description for when this in Tax Avoiders, the goal is to earn $1 million by the year's end. That's $1 million after taxes, mind you, because the IRS, tax sheltered investments, and other income issues all come into play. Well, that sounds like a fun game.
Yeah. It's a little bit like let's play the game of life.
Does your 8-year-old child insist on wearing a tie every day? Well, we've got the game for him or her.
So apparently they never heard the Steve Martin bit of being a millionaire and not paying taxes. You know, he says step one, get $1 million. And then step two, when they ask you about taxes, just say, I forgot.
Perfect.
Never get real small.
So
I looked at the gameplay videos for this game. It looks really pretty lousy.
Yeah.
It's definitely not like a shining high moment in the Atari 2600 canon.
Yeah.
So.
But this is sealed, and if you leave it sealed, then no problems.
I think it might be in the same, you know, genre as Adventures in Accounting.
I don't know this, but that sounds good.
I was just making that up. Oh. I was thinking if I wanted to make some 2600 games, what are some of the most exciting things I could think about?
Pitfall, you know? Yara's Revenge, River
E.T.?
Raid. E.T., but there's some really good, actually some, like a handful of very good Kaboom. Like there's some really good, highly replayable Atari 2600 games. Like there's not a ton, but there's some that are excellent.
I spent a lot of time on Battlezone. On the 2600, it's nothing like Battlezone the arcade. It's not the vector graphics kind of deal, but it was a really fun game. It was really well done.
I think that the games I spent the most time playing, I really liked when I was a child, the Empire Strikes Back game, when you're on a speeder trying to get the AT-ATs on Hoth. And I played Breakout a lot, and it's funny, I remember my mother was very good at Breakout, and I remember not grokking how an old person could be good at Breakout in video games. And I realized that she's far younger than I am now.
Right.
So that's pretty scary.
Have you become good at Breakout then?
Nobody's
become
a mother.
Is that the moral of the story?
Well, I haven't played a long time, but yes.
All right. Although
my little Breakout story, lost my mother maybe in 2009, 2010. She died of cancer, and I got her one of those... you know, the little video game thing to play, little Jack's, you know, game, you know, joystick paddle thing. And just because, you know, pass your time, take your mind off things. And I got to play some Breakout with her as an adult, you know, when she was in hospice care. She only had, you know, a very short time left. And for a brief period there, for, you know, there was a day or two where I got to spend time with her and she was happy. And that was for the last time I saw her happy. So she passed away a short time later. So I sent a little note to Waz about that, just saying, hey, man, you know, I know you don't care, but this game you made many years ago brought final moment of happiness. And he wrote back and he said, thank you so much for sharing that.
I think Waz would care about that. Nice. I think he was highly motivated by exactly that kind of thing. Good guy.
Yeah, so it was very nice that he said, replied their note and said, thank you for sharing that.
Nice.
Yeah, it's neat that you had a chance to do that. And now I will move on to what seems much less important now.
Oh, sorry.
The next eBay item. But,
sorry.
No, it was worth hearing the story for sure. But
yep.
I meant that as a happy story.
Yeah. Say. No, and it was, but still. It does make this monorail computer seem a little less interesting, but it's still kind of interesting. So the next thing I have, it's a vintage monorail complete personal computer model 133, and it comes with all the parts and it comes with a box, and it's all pretty complete. I never heard of this. I thought monorail, that sounds kind of cool. Yeah, maybe that'll be interesting. And I looked into it a little bit there, and I guess this is not the first model, but this is an early model of a kind of like a consumer PC. You know, it's supposed to be kind of like a cheap PC that you can use from, I don't know when this was, 97, something like that. Anyway, it looks kind of neat. It's got a flat screen that is essentially also the computer. So it's a little bit like a luggable that you can't lug, but, and it has a separate computer and a mouse. And I looked into it a little bit, just out of curiosity, to see what I could find out about the monorail. And I found a video of someone who had, basically, I think he was working at an electronics recycler or something, and found one of these, you know, sort of on the top of the pile of TVs that was going to be, you know, headed for demolition, and he took it out. And apparently the one that he got was monorail number 16. There was a little plaque on it that said, you know, like this was the 16th of the first 30 that were, you know, ever sold or made. And so that was kind of cool just to see the video of this. I'm not sure that I necessarily would want the actual monorail computer that is on eBay, and it's $400. So it's, you know, you have to want it a fair amount.
One of the cool things about it, though, is I think from my little bit of research, these came out in the late 90s, like 97. Uh-huh. So it's basically an all-in-one computer, but it predates the iMac.
Mm-hmm.
So that's neat. You would think this would be like a knockoff. I would look at this and go, it's a black version of an eMac or something. Nope, totally predates it. Another neat thing about it is it has a 10.4-inch little LCD screen built in, and it looks like it's got like a 4-inch bezel around the outside.
Yeah.
Like, little tiny screen in the middle of a big old bezel.
I noticed that. Yeah. The bezel kind of like outweighed the LCD 2 to 1.
But it's basically a like 133 megahertz Pentium processor. So it's a Pentium computer from the late 90s, but a very different look than you'd normally see, with a like slot-loading floppy on the side, and it's cool. I don't want one, but I've never seen one like it before.
Yeah, I think it is one of those things that I would be kind of happy if one appeared, but I don't think I would buy one.
Are you?
I'm not suggesting
you haven't
anything,
bought one.
But and back on the YouTube video, actually, if you look through the comments, there are also a couple of people who write in and saying, oh, you know, I worked at Monorail and helped design the system, and the plaque said someone's name on it, and they're referring to like remembering working with this guy who I think was one of the people.
Wow, that's super
cool. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. I was the fifth or sixth employee at Monorail. So yeah, I mean, the fact that you have the original designers kind of like weighing in on YouTube is also pretty cool. All right, let's see. Here's another thing that no one's going to buy, but it turns out, and I think this may only be on the German version of eBay. I haven't actually tried to load it on the, I didn't find it by searching, at least on the US version of eBay, but there's a Commodore 65, for 25,000 euros.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and I think this is the opening bid. That is not the buy it now price. That is the starting.
Yeah, these things, they're not in Apple One territory yet, but, you know, they're some of the recent prices for the 65s that have sold place them firmly in the I ain't ever going to have one category.
Yeah.
The Apple Ones now are starting at about $400,000 or $500,000.
Mm. Anyway, it's kind of neat to see one more. I mean, like, I sort of feel like I've seen probably three of these be sold over the time that I've been doing RCR.
We had one on display at BCFE's last year.
A real actual 65?
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Cool. It says serial number 60.
Yeah. Well, I think there is somewhere it said that they were probably only 200 of these to begin with.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. And they're in a variety of states of functioning or not.
Right.
Depending on where they were in the cycle.
Well, and it never quite actually got released, right? So all of them are prototypes of some form or another. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's not a production model.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's one more if you were looking for those.
The good thing for me is that the shipping on this for me is only 16 euros. For once, I get the cheaper shipping than you guys get.
Nice. Well, you better pull the trigger on this.
I'm going to buy this right now.
Yeah. You can't afford
to buy two. Yeah, one to keep in the box, one to use.
Excellent. Okay, so the next thing is actually much more affordable. It is a Canadian Tire VIC-20 games cassette.
Go Canada!
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. I guess this was a special. If you bought a VIC-20 at Canadian Tire, you would get this cassette with it.
There was a tire shop selling VIC-20s.
Well, Canadian Tire is called that, but it's really more like a Walmart type thing. But it just has a lot of automotive stuff.
Oh, I see.
It's like a little department store because they'll have whole kitchen sections and garden sections and mm-hmm. Been around forever and ever and ever. Just grew out of a tire thing, but many many decades ago.
So this cassette itself is just a cassette, and there seems to be a case that it's in, but they actually came with a little bit more elaborate art. You know, there's an actual insert. So I have a link there somewhere in the show notes to what the actual cover should have looked like. And I have no idea how common these are. My guess is that they aren't super common, but I thought it was kind of a neat thing. And this is not a super expensive auction either. It is starts at $9.99 US, and it's shipping out of Nova Scotia. So might even be cheaper in Canada, except that you might already have one if you're in Canada.
We are issued them when we turn 16.
That's right.
It's a whole Ready Player One thing going on where we're still trying to solve a puzzle. Right. Everyone's kind of getting tired of it, to be honest.
Let's see.
I threw another link in under yours because currently there is a 1530, the data set, the Commodore cassette player, on eBay at the moment that comes with one of these ones sitting inside it.
Oh, that's pretty funny. So
you can pick up a player and the cassette as a 1-2 punch. Buy it now for me, $37.81 Canadian, which is, I think, $29.99 US.
Yeah, exactly.
The 1530 was that little chocolate data set for the plus 4 and 16, right?
Oh, but this one look is white taupe, whatever that
is. The white thing.
Yeah.
It's got the VIC-20.
Maybe
look.
I got my numbers wrong. Huh.
This one is pretty filthy. It's leaning towards brown.
Trying to get there. The fun thing about Canadian Tire, which maybe Americans wouldn't know, is it has its own currency. So there's Canadian Tire money, which is essentially just like coupons you get. But when you buy anything at Canadian Tire, if you pay cash, you get back a tiny amount of money in the form of their own currency. And this is just a thing we all accept. So you buy something for $20 or $18, you give them $20, you'll get back your $2 change, and you'll also get like 10 cents of Canadian Tire money, these little tiny printed bills that are basically in pennies, and people save them up, and you can use them only at Canadian Tire. Like, they have their own barter currency, and somehow this is just a thing that's always existed.
Very cool.
That's amazing. Yeah.
It's pretty weird.
I wonder how it's, I wonder how the exchange rate has changed.
Well, it just counts as money. Like, it's not an expiry date. Like, they basically hand you a little bill that's worth 5 cents at Canadian Tire.
So it's 1-to-1 with Canadian
dollars.
5 cents
is 5 cents, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really just coupons, but it's a bizarre thing that you can use them, and it's a thing we all know here in Canada.
All right, let's see. I think the last auction I had was, it's actually sort of an example of an auction. What I'm linking to you specifically here is a lot of 10 utility tools, vintage demo discs. And these are all, so in this particular one we have, 10 discs. These were essentially, they were picked up at like big computer fairs or whatever, where you had like lots of vendors with their software stands, you know, giving out little demo discs. And so and they're all generally PC discs. This seller has a bunch of these, you know, so I've linked to one instance of these, but there are several other sort of collections of 50 and 10, you know, like medical discs and law discs and things like that. And for the most part, they are demos. But it's kind of interesting because I suspect that, like, I'm not convinced that the demos were preserved. There may be a bunch of things here that are sort of like, you know, movies of you know, programs running or whatever that no one has anymore. So I thought that was kind of cool. In this particular lot, there's a Super Key and Sidekick demo disc and an X-Tree demo disc, and you know, some other things that I hadn't heard of. Tree View. But anyway, so I think it would be interesting. I already bought the one that I wanted. but I think the thing is that I myself am not I have not committed deeply to the PC preservation effort. You know, I've been mostly focusing on other platforms, and this seems like it might be a little bit more like further than I personally want to go. But I think it's worth taking a look at this as a kind of a preservation opportunity, or just a neat thing.
I've been thinking of taking up the fight against PC preservation.
Right, buy them and burn them.
Exactly, be a force of evil. Because, you know, someone's got to, or maybe not. Still holding those old grudges.
Yeah.
Taking things way too seriously.
The seller, essentially, I think what the story of the seller is that they ran a store or something like that and went to the shows and picked up all everybody's little demo discs and stuff and then saved them. And now they're getting rid of them. So so it's interesting to see. I have the one that kind of made me leap on it and buy the one that I did buy had a demo of sort of, it was like an enhanced BASIC called Better BASIC, and it was by a company called Summit Software. And I used this when I was it was probably 1988, something like that, when I was doing programming while in high school. I did some programming in this language, and I really liked it. I thought, you know, the manual looked very cool. It was a neat system, and you know, then years went by, and you know, I came back to it, and it's almost as if this language never existed. I mean, the internet barely knows anything about this thing, and I've never seen anything related to it until one of these lots had a demo disc for Better BASIC. And so I immediately grabbed that because at least it proves that I'm not making it up. It's not like the Berenstain Bears or whatever, you know, like it.
That Shaq movie.
Right. but anyway, yeah, I mean, I think I suspect that it might be kind of cool to look at these demos of programs that failed and that kind of thing. But that's it. I think that's the end of my eBay list.
All right. Well, and I looked it up. The 1530 is actually that white data set you guys are talking about that is, you know, at Commodore activities, people are tripping over those. I imagine those are the ones that Evan has a million of in his warehouse.
Yes, I was going to say that.
And the 1531 is the one that went with the TED machines that had the chocolate color. It's a bit more rare. Mm-hmm. So we're to the closing discussions. Parting shots. You know, we're gonna land this baby. So, Carrington, any last words?
Canadian Tire money is the future. When the apocalypse comes, I'll be glad I hoarded that.
Are we able to mine it like Bitcoin?
Absolutely.
Well, that's a good thing to know. All right, so you preppers out there, get on that.
I prefer to call them preppies, Jack, but yes.
Jack, what about you?
You know the old Atari VCS, which was the early name of the Atari 2600, classic video game system? Well, we've talked a bit before that today's Atari has a new device coming out that they've been calling the Atari Box. Well, guess what? They decided to rename it the Atari VCS.
And it looks like one.
I just think it's very confusing. Like, why name something after a 40-year-old product? I don't know.
Have you heard about the launch of it or the display that happened at the GDC?
Actually, no.
So I'll grab a link. I remember reading on 8-Bit Central, something like that. So recently at GDC, the Game Developers Conference, Atari put out an announcement saying, hey, we're going to be there and we're going to show off the Atari VCS or the Atari Box or whatever. And everyone's looking at the list of vendors at GDC and said, but you're not listed. It's how weird. Well, they do show up and they show up, but they're not at the GDC. They're in a hotel room across the street from GDC, and they've got it on display. But then people realize when they get there that it's like a non-functional model. It's just like, here's a box, and they say that it works, but it doesn't actually work, and it's got two controllers, one of which is just like an empty box. And it's like, it was really weird and shady. So
I don't know what's going on.
That was recently. That was at like the 2018. Yeah. So, yeah.
I don't know what's going on anymore. It's crazy.
Okay, I found the list. Yeah, there's in a suite across the street from GDC, Atari attempted to showcase a non-functional Atari VCS game console. So we'll have a link to 8-Bit Central's blog about that. It was a very interesting read.
Oh, man.
It's almost like going back to the 70s. Like, you know, how people would bring the not quite ready for primetime products to the
right.
conventions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe the Apple III had something like that, too. Like there was, like, they had to be brought over to some, like, Disneyland hotel or something. It was not actually in the main area to actually see the Apple III work.
In Halt and Catch Fire, they showed that kind of stuff a few times where there would be a...
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and that's kind of my only, well, not even memory, my only image of this sort of thing is, yeah. you know, taking it. So it probably it's a very standard thing. Maybe it was like in the tradition of old Atari.
It is a standard thing. I mean, right. I've spent most of the last 20 years my daytime career as a journalist for computer trade magazines, and I go to, you know, trade conferences all the time. That is a very standard practice. Okay. Is that a lot of times companies, big and small, for whatever reason, decide they want to show certain people, you know, invited people something, but they don't want to have a big public booth, and they get a suite in the hotel. It's a pretty common practice.
Yeah, you'd also be able to control. If you're trying to like control the message, and I want these 10 or 50 or whatever journalists to
yes,
get access
exactly.
and control it, so it's not just a crap. So I can see real pros and cons, but it's kind of weird that they announce this thing, and then it's like, well, it's not really. It's just like a milled box or whatever. Like here, imagine this was a console.
You could probably infer something from it if you knew who was invited to see it, but we'll never know that.
Ah, was it you?
No, definitely not.
So. First conclusion is already in place. Yeah. So the actual thing, do we know when it's supposed to be out?
I don't think they've really said.
When
this year, I think, but
okay,
it's not really determined.
Yeah, I'm not anticipating being too impressed by this, but
no, I don't know. I'm filled with doubt.
The same vein as the Commodore thing and the Oregon Trail thing. It's not for us. Flashbacks, you know. How is it different from a flashback? It's not for us. It's for the nostalgia.
The Flashback 2 was the hackable one. That one was for me.
Yes,
you can mod that to run actual carts.
This was supposed to be a new, like, modern device. It's supposed to be, I think they were saying, like, roughly a mid-2017 decent PC in terms of graphics and computing power. They want to have new games on it, too. It's not just meant to be just a retro thing, but I don't know.
I was going to say, how much graphics computing power you need if you're going to play games in 1978?
Right.
Well, but it sounds like they want to play write and play new things. But then at that point, how is it not just competing with regular consoles?
Or exactly. The Raspberry Pi and stuff like that. Like it's such a chicken and egg thing. Tough market to break into. If you want to sell games, but you got a platform, nobody wants to make the games because nobody's bought the platform. Nobody buys platforms because it hasn't any games. And tough business to break into.
Well, Paul, what have you got for parting shots here?
Well, I'm not sure how recently this started, but I think it was pretty recent. There's a show that started on Channel 4, the British channel, called Rob Beckett's Playing for Time. And I thought, all right, well, this is, you know, the idea, what I knew about it was that it was essentially supposed to be like going back and playing the video games of old and, you know, sort of televising it. I thought, all right, well, who knows? I can maybe watch this, I guess. The premise is just ridiculous. So essentially what supposed to have happened here is this, and I don't know if people may not know who Rob Beckett even is, but I feel like I know him from, he's quite often on Mock the Week, a panel show. And I think he's been actually on the other gaming show that I'm about to mention. In principle, what's supposed to happen is that he gets sent back in time with a guest and lands in the 1980s and plays, you know, in the year of the release of some video game. And then they play this and they have to like play this game in order to advance through time till they get back to...
Okay, this sounds amazing.
Yeah, it sounds like more Ready Player One just sort of stuff in the universe, I guess. But anyway, so they go back, and I think the very first thing they did was Pac-Man. You know, so they went back to whenever that was in 1982, I think it was. So they played that. And actually, the set, it's kind of amusing because they do set up this room to be like a 1980s room that they teleport into, and then a 1990s room, and so forth. And so it feels like it could be something, and I've only seen one, so, you know, who knows. Anyway, it's a thing to look at if you're looking for retro games on television, this is one such thing. There's another one that I'm sure I mentioned before, and I haven't seen all of them, but it's called Dara O'Brien's Go 8-Bit.
That's the one I was just thinking of. I was going to mention that,
yeah,
too.
And that one I do think is kind of fun. It's, you know, in a ridiculous way, but I think basically just having Dara O'Brien on anything
makes it fun. Totally, yep.
So...
He is super, super funny, and I agree. The Go 8-Bit Show. I watched a bunch of that, maybe all of that. I don't know. And it's a silly game show, but I really liked it.
Yeah. And I mean, it does actually. You know, they do talk about games that we know from the olden days. You know.
Yep.
So, and also some new ones that I don't know, but that's all right.
I had to look up who Rob Beckett is, and I recognized, like, when I saw his picture, I'm like, oh, that guy. I know him from 8 out of 10 Cats.
Oh yeah, I bet so, that's. I haven't quite gotten into watching that, but I am aware of it.
He's the blonde one with the big teeth.
Yeah,
right. I know it was that guy.
Yeah. Anyway, but so if you have some access to Commonwealth TV, this is, you know, a way to do this.
Well, speaking of which, that's a new thing I did. I signed up for BritBox, which is kind of like the Netflix for British TV stuff, and I dig it. It's like Netflix for people that don't really know how to make a Netflix interface quite as good. Like it never remembers what you're watching. I'm like, dude, I just watched episode 7 of something. What do you think I want you to show me when I log in? But, you know, good way to very cheaply get, you know, legal access to a bunch of British shows. But I don't know if this is on it. I hope so.
Yeah, that's. I would be interested in that because I have my own sort of. Gray market ways of getting a hold of these things, and I wouldn't mind, you know, going legit.
Yeah, for like $8 a month, and just go, oh, fine. Yes.
Yeah.
There you go. I'll just do it.
Cool. And then the last thing I put in the show notes was I just, like a day or two ago, got an issue of Newsweek. This is probably well known to many people that this exists, but there was an issue of Newsweek that Apple bought all of the ads in. So it was basically an election special, November, December, 1984. Then, and basically all of the ad space in the entire magazine was Apple. And it's actually quite a lot. I mean, like there are a lot of ads, and I hadn't actually seen all of them scanned online. I've seen pictures of a few, but, it turns out, you know, when I've got the thing in my hands, it's like every third or fourth page is an Apple ad. Very weird.
I thought Quinn Dunkey on Twitter gave a good response to that because you had said you got this magazine from 1984 and it's all just Apple ads. And she says, any ads for the Apple IIc, which of course came out in 1984. You're like, and she's like, nope, of course not.
Yeah, no. No, it's
so
all
just kind of tells you, poor Apple IIc.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it is. It's absolutely, Mac is the only thing that is even mentioned at all.
They're like desperately trying to make that make some money.
Yeah. Anyway, it's kind of interesting. I kind of wished that the rest of the magazine was more interesting, but you know, this is basically just after Reagan got reelected, right? And so Reagan's on the cover. It says Avalanche. And the way I got this was, in fact, from an eBay auction. It seemed to be basically like Reagan collectibles. So with this, I got the Time from that and a newspaper saying, you know, Reagan won and. All that stuff, but I did get at least this thing. Anyway, that's my news.
I wonder what that cost them.
I'm sure it was not trivial.
Could not have been cheap.
But I mean, the Super Bowl ad probably cost a fair amount too. So,
yeah, it's true. And just the production of that Super Bowl ad—that's probably documented. We could probably find out somewhere what that cost.
I think it was $1 million, wasn't it, to buy the airtime? Wasn't it just to buy the airtime and not the production?
Don't know. Wow. Could be.
Well, Evan, thanks very much for joining in with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I always enjoy it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of fun. You have any parting shots for us?
VCF, VCF, VCF.
Nice.
Anyone who's never been to one, I mean, there's events all over the country and starting to expand to other countries. If you've never been to one, do yourself a favor and try to get to one someday. It's really like no other event you'll ever be to.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I went to the last one at the Bay Area, and that was double cool because it had the VCF and it had the Computer History Museum. So that was just, you know, that's like a 1-2 punch.
Unfortunately, I didn't even get to go to that one last year, but I went the year before when we brought it back, 2016.
Yeah, it was great. And I guess parting shot for me is, I mentioned this on Twitter, but I'm going to do a little, shameless plug here. I'm trying to put together either a podcast episode, probably that, or a blog entry or something on the use of FPGAs in the vintage computer world. Things that are made with them, things that people are working on. And I want to thank the people who did throw me some information back on Twitter and through email about some of the projects, some of which I didn't know about. But then as I kept, trying to hunt this down, I found more and more things that are being done with FPGAs, whether or not it's conspicuous that it's on the surface that it's being done with a programmable logic device. They're in the heart of these things. It's just really fascinating. I think there's a story there. So,
yeah. Well, the most famous example is Jerry Ellsworth's DTV. Was that FPGA?
Oh, I wasn't even aware of that. See, there's another one.
Yeah. And as I mentioned, Stephen Edwards, who's a computer science professor at Columbia University, is giving a talk on that very subject and how to do that on Friday at the CFPs this year.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting stuff. I know that people are working with these things. And if you don't know what an FPGA is or what the heck I'm talking about, don't worry about that, because I'm going to cover it when I get to this. So
it's like a golf tournament or something, right?
It is. Yeah, exactly. It's golf with bits is basically what it turns out to be. So, all right. Well, that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org. And the link for that is in the show notes. Great place. Wonderful watering hole for people interested in vintage computing.
And we thank you for using them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, great place to go hang out. I've got quite a few tips on repairing Commodore stuff over there in the Commodore-specific genre forum. You can find RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. We mentioned Ken Gagne is our Twitterer and does a great job keeping things active over there. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and we love to hear from you. We are a proud member of the Throwback Network. If you're interested in retro stuff, just in general, vintage computing, retro gaming, and all other things of the past, throwbacknetwork.net, where you can find that. And if you like the show, please write a review for us on iTunes. It helps everybody else to find us. And until next time...
Retro
Compute.
Trivia Fever!